In little more than two decades, we've gone from a position of energy independence to one in which almost half the oil we use comes from foreign countries at prices that are going through the roof. The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Good morning, I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International, a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program dedicated to the preservation of parks, wilderness, and special places. From the beaches, to the mountains, to the deserts, this is Tree Huggers International. Be careful, and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. We are recording the show today on location from the San Leo campus of MiraCosta College in North San Diego County, and we're very lucky to be joined today by filmmaker Peter Bick, the director of the film Carbonation, which takes an honest and often humorous look at not only the effects of fossil fuels and global warming, but also ways in which alternative energies already available could meet and surpass the current daily energy needs of the United States. The film has slowly been gaining some attention and traction and has won a slew of accolades, and we are really thrilled to have you joining us this morning, Peter. Welcome to Tree Huggers International, Peter Bick.
Nice to be here.
You know, this is a word that comes up a couple of times in your movie, but what is a terawatt, and why is 16 the magic number when it comes to terawatts?
A terawatt is a trillion watts. That's just simply what a terawatt is. When you add up all the energy used on the planet, all the power from transportation, cars and boats and trucks to buildings to what people use to cook with, and in Asia a lot of people use dung, you put all that into one number, and what we use on planet Earth right now is 16 terawatts of power, of energy, at the rate of 16 terawatts. And that is it. That's if you turned everything on and did everything on planet Earth, that's what we would need, the capacity to make. And so that's, the number's not magic, it's just a fact. And obviously, as more and more people come up into the middle class in Asia and Russia and Brazil, that number's going to go up. The joy of some of the statistics that we found is that right now, hitting planet Earth and you and me basically right now, because we're outdoors, 86,000 terawatts of solar power is hitting the Earth right now. 720 terawatts of wind is blowing around the Earth right now. And depending on who you talk to, and we use the lowest number because we want to be conservative in the movie, 32 terawatts of geothermal power is available right now. And so if we only use 16, only is a huge number, if we use 16, then we've got 86,000 at our disposal. So that's the connection we're looking for, is how do we mine that solar power? How do we mine that wind power and the geothermal power, which is more than we'd ever need?
When did carbon dioxide begin to turn against us? Or rather, when did we really enable carbon dioxide to begin working against us?
Well, carbon dioxide, I was just having breakfast with a scientist from Scripps. Carbon dioxide does not care what you think of it, he says. And it's not against us. It's just what it is. You know, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, which means when it goes up in the air, when carbon is emitted, it binds with oxygen, creates carbon dioxide. It goes up in the air, and it's a greenhouse gas. It's like a blanket. So the more carbon dioxide up in the air, the more blanket we have. So it's not against us. We're just finding out that if the planet warms a lot, the planet's going to change. And is it going to change in ways that we don't like? And the answer is yes. And will we be able to control any of it? And the answer is probably not. So, you know, the cartoon at the beginning of the film, you know, CO2 is, hey, I'm actually a pretty nice guy, right? And carbon dioxide's not a bad thing. It's a building block of all life. The trick is when you have a lot of it up there, the Earth is going to heat up faster. And there's a lot of other greenhouse gases, too. I was told just yesterday about a third of the greenhouse gas heat capacity right now, the things that are heating us up that are extra, man-made, added, that's about a third of the total greenhouse gases up there, like new chemicals that we're creating. So CO2 is about two-thirds of it, and then the rest of it's about a third. So, you know, our film focuses on carbon dioxide, so there's a lot more work to be done on communicating this stuff.
Well, and the movie makes it a point to remind the audience that we treat our skies and our atmosphere, as we do rivers and oceans, unfortunately, like a sewer.
Yeah.
And there is no cost or penalty for emitting CO2. And in fact, in our culture, it is valued. Doing so is a laudable sign of productive industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, how can we ever even begin to shift this paradigm to at least get across the idea that maybe if you're polluting like this, you should be paying to pollute for this?
You know, CO2 is not a pollutant, although the Supreme Court says it is. But everything that comes with the CO2 is the pollutant,
right?
The mercury, the NOx, the SOx, and all those things when you burn coal specifically, or methane when you're burning natural gas and all that stuff, or natural gas is methane. You know, you want to burn it. It still has carbon in it. And all the transportation fuels emit carbon. The idea that the sky and the rivers are commons is an idea that I like. Like, this is common area. We have to treat it in a way that no one has the right to pollute it because it's not theirs. And right now, it's like the sky is anyone's. How do we change that? I think really the bottom line is that once clean energy is cheaper than fossil fuel energy, it changes. I just think it's just that simple. All the other machinations, all the other policy things, they seem to be good ideas. We haven't seen them in action, but I think they would be good ideas. Like a price on carbon, I would love a price on carbon. And I have a libertarian friend who blew my mind at lunch the other day who also wants a price on carbon. And he's the last guy in the world that would want anything through the government. So I was pretty surprised by that. He and I have great conversations because we have disagree on so many things. But we agree on the energy piece. We agree on energy efficiency. We agree on the benefits of clean energy. And now I find we agree on a price on carbon. You know, so if you put a price on carbon, you make it more expensive to use the fossil fuels. Therefore, the clean energies would have a leg up. And everyone says, well, that's not the free market working. Well, guess what, folks? There is no free market with energy. Every coal plant was built with subsidies. Every nuclear plant is absolutely built with subsidies and insured with subsidies. I just learned the state of West Virginia gets $250 million a year in subsidies for the fact that they're giving us coal. So that's subsidies, folks. Then there's the external costs, the outside costs of using fossil fuels as a fuel. I live in Kentucky where 93% coal is our energy system. So when I have my refrigerator working, there's a good chance that there's a kid getting asthma because of it. So when you look at all the costs associated with just using coal, according to a Harvard study, the School of Public Health came out last February, if you just look at what it costs to use coal in the U.S. alone, the costs that aren't on our utility bills, the costs of getting the coal, which in a lot of cases is now blowing up mountains. And when you blow up the mountain, the rocks and all the everything, heavy metals go into the streams then don't work. And those streams and those mountains were cleaning the water that we use. So you have to build water purification plants to do that job. So there's cost there, just straight business costs. Those trucks transporting across our state roads, they tear up the roads like any truck does. But we pay for those roads to be repaired, not the coal companies who are benefiting from driving over those roads. There's an enormous amount of subsidies to the coal industry and health costs, enormous health costs to us as a society. And according to the Harvard study, it's between a third and a half a trillion dollars a year to use coal, the costs that aren't on our utility bills. Now imagine if those utility bills added that cost. Well, that's about 17 cents a kilowatt hour more. In Kentucky, they say we have cheap energy. It's 5 cents a kilowatt hour. Well, if it jumps to 22 cents a kilowatt hour, we've just gone 5 cents over what Californians pay with expensive. And you can see economically, things would shift very quickly. And we are paying that. It's not like this is, we're saying, add a tax. That is the tax. Tax already is there. We're paying it. You, me, my dad, my grandfather, my son, we are paying it. And so I say, let's reduce that carbon tax by putting a price on carbon. It'll actually reduce it.
It's funny, in the bluegrass state and also in West Virginia, where, especially in West Virginia, where they've got a lot of the really great coal, like the anthracite, just this week, one of the more conservative papers in West Virginia ran an editorial that said, you know, look, we really have to start looking past coal. You cannot sit around and decimate a mountain range, mountains, valleys, communities. And this is the least likely source you would see for this sort of reform, especially in a state like West Virginia, which is wholly reliant upon coal.
And the state of West Virginia and the state of Kentucky are suing the EPA because the EPA is trying to regulate the quality of life that's happening around the coal. Now, what's really, really, really important about the conversation about coal is there has to be jobs created in those towns and villages and counties. Because there's a lot of really good people who are working in the coal industry right now that will need new jobs. I want them to have new jobs. I want them to be well employed. I want them to have a way to be retrained, right? So that's a key. That's a key thing in any conversation about when you talk about, hey, let's reduce our use of coal. Let's make sure that jobs are created. And so that's a complication, but it's not an impossibility.
And in a lot of the communities in West Virginia and Kentucky where a lot of the mountaintop removal mining is going on, a lot of folks who live locally aren't even employed. A lot of this work is being done by machines, by explosives, and by experts from Wyoming or Texas.
Yeah, those are the poorest counties in the country. So if it's such a good, viable business for the local people, why are those the poorest counties in the country? And why are some of those people some of the sickest people in the country in a strictly health speaking way? They're not healthy because they're being killed, basically.
A lot of publicity about global warming deals with the vanishing glaciers in Glacier National Park in Montana, which is a wonderful place.
But we have pictures in the film that just show time, photo in the 50s, photo in the 70s, and the photo in this decade. And, you know, it's incontrovertible that those glaciers are receding. This isn't a political statement. This is chemistry and physics. But as we talk about all these things about climate, the film is very little on the climate and very big on the opportunity of business, of heroic Americans doing very cool things, like a one-armed wind farmer in Roscoe, Texas, decides he wants to gather 400 of his neighbors together to make one piece of land. So it's easy to contract with an energy company named Aon, and they build the world's largest wind farm. It still is the world's largest wind farm. That's just one guy who started that. He's a cotton farmer. It's astounding. Then we've got Bernie Carl up in Alaska, who's revolutionizing geothermal power so you can use low-temperature water, low-temperature being what he says, not as hot as McDonald's coffee, and make geothermal power from it, which was thought undoable before him. And he doesn't even think humans are causing climate change. But he likes clean air and he likes clean water. And he hates waste. He's like, build anything you want, just no waste. He says, build a nuclear plant, no waste. Build a coal plant, no waste. You know, that's his parameter, and that's his filter, and that's his mandate. And he's a hero. And if he and I don't agree on climate, okay, that's fine. But we agree on everything else about energy.
You agree on how to arrive at the solution.
Yeah. I mean, so I think the climate doorman has to chill. You know, it's like when you go to a Sundance, to the film festival, there's these really rude doormen, and you kind of figure they got shipped up from Los Angeles, and I lived in L.A. for 26 years, so that's not like an outsider comment. It's like those doormen are kind of, you know, let's let the doormen chill and let the climate conversation, it's real. I know it's real. A lot of people know it's real. Some people don't think it's real. Okay, we're not going to convince them. If they haven't been convinced yet, then it's going to be pretty hard. And that's a lot of energy taken to try to convince someone that climate change is real. Okay, well, why don't we convince them that solar's cool and wind is cool? Oh, wait a second. You don't need to convince them. 90% of Americans love solar power. 70% of Americans love wind power. Okay, energy efficiency makes sense to every single person who learns about it. Fine. Those three things, boom, that's enough common ground for me. Then let's work through all the problems to get through that stuff, the transmission lines and the not in my backyards and all that stuff.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International. I'm Tommy Howe, and we're joined today by filmmaker Peter Bick, who directed the feature film Carbon Nation, about the effects of our carbon footprint on global warming and an exploration of alternative energy innovations and successes. Now, for more information or to catch a trailer of the movie, go to carbonnationmovie.com. That's www.carbonnationmovie.com. You can check out the Carbon Nation blog, donate to the cause if you're so inclined, arrange a screening, all at carbonnationmovie.com. Now, we're recording the show today on location at the San Leo campus of MiraCosta College in Cardiff-by-the-Sea in coastal San Diego County. And keeping in mind these ideas of alternative energy resources, the geothermal segment in Carbon Nation with Bernie Carl is great. Not just because geothermal energy is interesting because it works so well or because it's so reliable, but because the science and mechanics behind it are just so completely, absolutely super cool. And there are some growing geothermal opportunities in Imperial County in Southern California, which are slowly gaining traction.
That's actually, my grandmother bought stock in a company in Imperial that was doing geothermal 30, 40 years ago. And so she passed away, gave it to my dad. He passed away and gave it to us. And I don't think it's worth very much right now. It's been a diluted stock. But one point that's on our DVD extras with Bernie Carl in Alaska is when you drill for oil, about 95% of what comes up is 200 to 250 degree water. And that is a nuisance to the oil companies. And they have to pump it back down. So that's more energy exerted. If they put one of these geothermal generators, turbines, that Bernie's working with UTC Power to build on top of that oil well, you could generate power. And according to Bernie, if you go into the state of Texas, there's 250,000 oil wells drilling. You put one of these units on each one of those oil wells, you have the equivalent of 10 nuclear power plants. 10 nuclear power plants of wasted energy from the oil wells of the water that no one wants. That's the story. The story is, where is the waste? I just learned the other night that there are times when power generators pay you to use their power because they're generating it, and if they don't get it out of the system, then it'll melt their power lines. You can't just sort of flare electrons like you can with methane. You know, when you go by any refinery, you see these flares. That's methane. You know, the oil industry didn't even think methane, natural gas, aka natural gas, was of value. And so they've been burning it for decades. Another byproduct of their drilling. And you just think about the oil companies, they're experts at drilling. So when we think about geothermal power, yes, there's geothermal power at Calpine up in Northern California, these great geothermal resources, super hot, right near the surface. It's all great. But if you drill down 10,000 feet, you're at hot rock. And if you just do a cycle of water up and down that to that hot rock, you have enough power for geothermal. And so wouldn't the oil companies be expert partners in doing that? You could drill a 10,000 foot well in Manhattan and create energy. You could do it anywhere. And so there's just opportunities that people haven't really thought of.
Well, the funny thing is, an outlet like an oil company, they're going to have a lot of engineers and a lot of very, very bright people.
But they do.
The engineers may not necessarily be particularly adept with innovation or looking beyond what we're trying to do. We're trying to drill for oil, so everything else is not part of the solution.
I certainly look at oil companies as sort of the biggest repository of profit right now. So wouldn't it be great if they used 10% of their profit on clean energy research? And so far, all I've heard is, well, we'll just buy the technology when someone else gets it up to snuff.
Right.
You know, which they have the money to do that too.
Yeah.
I mean, they're energy companies, right? So you got to figure at some point the fossils fuel is done. And if they're energy companies and they're really looking out for the best interests of their stockholders in the long run, you'd think that they'd be into other sources of energy. You know, the Pullman Car Company in 1925 did not think it would need to make an airplane to stay in business. And lo and behold, by 1950, or whenever that was, the Pullman Car Company was done, and the U.S. civilian aviation industry had kicked its ass. Transportation, they're both transportation. So I'm curious to see what energy companies have that long view and want to start working on it now. Because a 50-year plan is not stupid. A 50-year plan is smart. When you deal with quarterly profits, though, it's tricky. The quarterly profit report and the stock market just seem like they're perversions. I don't see how they help society. I really don't. Because if you could report every 3 years, I'm speaking to a woman yesterday at lunch, if you could report every 3 years, how much more innovation would you be pushing? How much differently would you be spending your money as a corporation if you didn't have to report to the world profit every quarter? You know, when they say there's a net zero energy building, that doesn't mean every quarter it's sending out more electrons than it's using. It means over a period of a year, it's sending out more electrons than it's using. So why is a quarter so important? You know, why is 3 months so magical? It's a perversion. It's unnecessary. And it's ruining so many different things. That'd be a film right there, the quarter problem.
Well, it could be argued that that is a detriment to innovation.
Definitely.
You know?
No question.
You have to go and produce this quarter.
Yeah.
We need a result in 3 months.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of innovation takes more than 3 months, more than 3 years.
A lot of it takes more than 3 months. 3 years, you could get a lot done.
I want to talk about the U.S. military's take on global warming and also energy innovation and the plans they're drawing up now with the consequences they foresee from global warming in mind.
It's from risk. The U.S. military knows that if there's instability around the world, that they're going to be called on to try to stabilize it. And when they look at the risk of climate change, again, risk assessment is a great way to look at it. You know, is it 100% sure that it's going to happen?
Yeah.
Nothing's 100% sure that it's going to happen. But it's high numbers right now. It's in the 90s. So just with risk management, let's say it's going to happen and the oceans rise 5 feet. Well, that's a lot of Bangladesh. And that's hundreds of millions of people that are going to be moving to an area that can't handle them. There's going to be instability. And as a gentleman says in our film, there's going to be wars or nearly wars. So the U.S. military knows that. And they know they're going to have to get in there. And they know that they're already overstretched. So that's one piece. And the CIA knows this. You know, the NSA knows this. These things are not debated in those halls. They're not. So with the military, one story that we found at Fort Irwin, California, it's up in the Mojave Desert, and it's about, I think it's about 20 miles from Mojave, the town. And that base was powered by one power line run by SoCal Edison from Mojave to the base. One power line. So when Brigadier General Dana Petard got there, who's in our film, he was the base commander. And this is where we train every soldier that goes to Iraq and Afghanistan. Every Army soldier is trained there. They have a fake Iraqi village. They hire amputees to walk around with ketchup on their arms to make it look like they just got blown up and give people a sense of what they're going to see. And one day they got a note from the utility, hey, we've got to do some repairs on the lines. You're going to be out of power for 18 hours. Fort Irwin. And so Brigadier General Dana Petard had an aha moment at that point. He said, this is ridiculous. We are going to be off the grid in 2 years, period. And so he has started, and then they all get transferred every 2 years, so he doesn't finish it. But he started the process, and right now SoCal Edison and Fort Irwin are partnered to build this giant solar array on the land, so SoCal Edison doesn't have to buy land. We already own it as U.S. taxpayers. And they're going to produce so much energy that a lot of it's going to go to Vegas. There you go. There's a problem and a solution, and it's solving more than what the problem was. And it gets that base from ever being pulled offline. And so every base, every military base wants to be off the grid, wants to be self-sustaining with their energy. And they don't want to build diesel power generators or coal plants. They want to use geothermal, like the Navy, China Lake, big geothermal. Think of that. I mean, the U.S. military is the biggest user of energy, one of the biggest landowners, one of the biggest building owners. If they decide to make every building energy efficient, they're going that way. That's huge. Creates industry. Creates, you know, right now, if you said we want every building in New York to be energy efficient, and you said here's the budget, you'd still have a problem because there's not enough people trained to do it. So all that, all those cogs in the wheel that we want going forward need to be built. So people need to be trained and all these things. So when the U.S. Department of Defense says we want to go this way, you know, like they did with the microchip, GPS, the internet, even I think breast cancer research, the detectors are coming from a military application. That's huge. And then when you hear the Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, say using fossil fuels in any of our ships and helicopters and whatever the Navy, which is also the Marines, using fossil fuels in any of them, if it comes from the Gulf of Hormuz or the Gulf of Mexico, it's a bad national security decision because we know that stuff's going to run out. So he's pushing for full biofuels and all those pieces of gear by 2020. Now, you'll see people shrug and go, yeah, right. You know, even in the military when they hear that. But people shrugged and said, yeah, right, when Roosevelt said how many planes he wanted Detroit to make, and they tripled it. So it's all possible. And the military is in a good position of creating a lot of what we want because they have so much of our money.
And the military innovates. The military innovated socially when Truman integrated the military in the late 40s.
Yeah, that is action, social action. So when the military trains all of its families to be more energy efficient in the housing, that's 2 million people cycling through every 2 years to different housing, they go home. They go home and they then have those habits and they teach their neighbors. And Walmart, you know, was it 1.2 million people work at Walmart, something like that? They're training their employees to be energy efficient. Those folks are going home. So these, like, these sort of big behemoths that the environmental world has been not real happy with over the decades now have the power to do some real pushing of the needle in the right direction.
Well, and a couple of things that you pointed out, like, for example, the large solar array that they're building at Fort Irwin. You know, when you see something like that, you go, why doesn't every single box store in Southern California have these solar panels on it and push back into the grid? You wouldn't even need transmission lines then at that point. Forget about the 20 miles between Fort Irwin and Mojave.
The new transmission lines.
Mm-hmm.
You'd use the same ones that are in the end.
The footprint.
You know, the transmission lines that are here would be enough because you're putting solar on the buildings within the whole transmission system. And, you know, SoCal Edison's doing that on rooftops in Fontana, millions of square feet of solar panels. And so, again, the transmission lines aren't needed because they're already inside the grid. It's happening. And the more it becomes economic, the more it's going to happen.
And also what you're talking about buildings, I mean, of course, you know, the most ecologically sound and green building is the one that's already built. And it's great seeing Van Jones in Carbon Nation really excitedly demonstrating how you can get a lot of people at work full time in a career and a job, which doesn't seem to have any end, and that is in retrofitting buildings to be more green. What a great idea.
Yeah, it's a sustainable business model. And every dollar that's spent on energy efficiency, you get $2 back in energy savings. That's just simple math. There's nothing crazy about that. You just have to get that first dollar. And that's the trick, you know, because a lot of low-income folks don't have that first dollar. And a lot of people who middle class don't have that first dollar. You know, they're not going to spend the money to put solar panels on their house if they can't get help doing it. So I say if we can help coal companies to build coal plants and we can help oil companies to drill, why can't we help everybody retrofit their homes, get some solar panels thrown up there? Let's equal the playing field.
What's the story with algae, and how is it this green, slimy stuff from ponds packs such a huge amount of energy?
Mm-hmm.
How is that?
Well, algae breathes in CO2 like all plants. It brings it back out of the atmosphere. And then there's different types of algae. There's probably tens of thousands of different types of algae. And everyone's looking for the algae that produces the most lipids, which are fats, which then can be refined into fuel, whether it's gasoline, but it can also be refined into diesel, which ethanol can't. So all the Jet A fuels and the diesel fuels, ethanol can't do that, but the algae can. And so everyone's hunting for that algae. Everyone's hunting for the way to grow the algae faster, and everyone's hunting for the way to do it with the least amount of water. And some people are talking about breeding the algae, you know, sort of like crossbreeding like we do with tomatoes and roses. Mm. Some people are talking about just finding the right ones. And Craig Venter, the guy who sort of started the whole Human Genome Project, has a deal with Exxon, $500 million, to create algae fuel. And he's basically redesigning DNA in the lab. He's like programming code on how he's building the DNA, inserting that into algae and seeing how that works. And that one's a little unnerving to me, because what happens when that algae gets out? And he said at a conference, the algae won't get out. And how does he know that? It's algae. It's tiny. I like the closed system algae systems, where you're not losing a lot of water evaporation. It's all in tubes and things, so you don't have a lot of water need, and you don't need as large a footprint as the big ponds where they just sort of skim it off the top and grow some more algae. That's what I like. It'd be great if they could find the natural algae. And then there's this, it's a medicine that was being used to cure cancer. And then somehow someone figured out it increased fat growth. And they've put it into algae, and the lipid count went way up. And the cool thing was, the lipids come out of the algae and just float to the top of the water without killing the algae. And every other design needs you to kill and squeeze the algae like you would a grape, you know, to get the juice out, to get the lipid, the fat out. So that's a real interesting thing. So I think algae has a lot of potential. It's very expensive to get that lipid into a refined fuel right now. But, you know, cell phones were super expensive 20 years ago. It's just a matter of time and technology. And there's a lot of people working on it. I mean, that's the thing. There are a lot of people and institutions and companies and research labs, students. There's just a lot of people working on it. And they're going for the gold. They want to be a player in that $6 trillion worldwide energy market. It's a big play, and they want to be part of it, and more power to them. So our film is Carbon Nation, and you were mentioning our website, which is carbonnationmovie.com. The film's available on most cable carriers in the U.S., and it's available on iTunes, Amazon for purchase or Amazon streaming, and Netflix for rental and Netflix streaming, and you could buy the DVD direct from us on our website. And we're looking at ways to get the DVD in bulk to students and schools, and we want companies to buy the DVD so their employees' behavior shifts and the companies save money, more money than the DVD cost.
CarbonNationMovie.com is the website. That's CarbonNationMovie.com. You can check out a clip, pass it along to a friend, and hopefully check out a screening of the film. I know you lived in Los Angeles for a while, so you're probably used to this question, and I'm going to close with this question, but what are you working on now?
I'm working on marketing Carbon Nation, and we're also early days on developing it into a TV series so that we can keep telling these really cool stories about these really cool people, and we'll make it worldwide because it's happening all over.
Peter Bick, it is really nice having you on the program.
Thanks,
today.
Tommy.
Thanks for making the time. Thanks for having all these screenings you've been arranging in Southern California. It was great seeing the movie.
We got to thank Lee Barkin for the San Diego tour.
Lee Barkin has been very instrumental also in making this show come together as well.
So amazing.
Thank you, Lee. Hey, Peter, nice meeting you, and best of luck with your future projects, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Tommy.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International. I'm Tommy Howe. Thanks once again to our guest, filmmaker Peter Bick, the director of the movie Carbon Nation. And for more information and to catch a trailer of the movie Carbon Nation, go to CarbonNationMovie.com. A very special thanks to Tree Huggers International friend, CPA, and lead energy and clean tech practice expert Lee Barkin for his enormous help in making this interview come together today. Thank you, Lee. Thanks also to the staff and management at MiraCosta College in Cardiff-by-the-Sea for their help with today's program. And again, Carbon Nation is online at CarbonNationMovie.com. For more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, go to the Tree Huggers International website at treehuggersintl.com. That's www.treehuggersintl.com. And you can access the Tree Huggers International page via the FM949 website at fm949sd.com. Also find social media outlets for Tree Huggers International at Facebook and Twitter, and our Twitter account is at TreeHuggersINTL. Tree Huggers International content is also available on iTunes. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International. We'll be back again same time next Sunday with another take on natural science and environmental affairs as we continue our mission to preserve parks, wilderness, and special places on Tree Huggers International. Thanks for making us a part of your Sunday morning, and enjoy the rest of your weekend. Be well.